From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Coming up next in this morning's opening hour of Forum, we'll be joined by Harvard political philosopher Michael Sandel, author of The Case Against Perfection, Ethics in the Age of Genetic Engineering. That's the Forum hour ahead, and it'll include your calls and emails right after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to this morning's forum. Michael Sandel is the Ann T. and Robert M. Bass Professor of Government at Harvard and author of Public Philosophy and, more recently, The Case Against Perfection, Ethics in the Age of Genetic Engineering. He's also a former member of President Bush's Council on Bioethics, and he joins us for this forum hour. We welcome you. Good morning.
Thanks, Michael. Pleasure to be here.
Pleasure to have you here. And let's begin, actually, before we talk about serving on the President's Council, which I know people will want to hear about. Let's talk about your book, because you begin with a couple of lesbian partners who were condemned for choosing a deaf child. And what's the lesson in all this? They were deaf. They wanted a child that was deaf. And so genetic selection was their choice. What did we learn from that?
It was. Well, there are two objections people had to what they did, which was intentionally to conceive a deaf child. Many people objected because they felt that it was creating a child with a disability from the start. And there was then a big debate about whether deafness is a disability or a form of identity and community, a distinctive mode of language. I think it was troubling quite apart from the debate about whether deafness is a disability or not, I think it also can be questioned because it was trying to create a certain kind of child by design. And I think that's troubling even if parents try to create so-called designer children who have qualities, let's say higher IQ or greater physical strength or athletic ability conceivably down the line, that are clearly not disabilities.
We're tinkering with nature. Is that what concerns you? Or, I mean, because it's been pointed out, I'm sure you realize, by folks who make the argument against, your argument against, that
right.
It's choice, that people choose mates with high degree of intelligence or with good looks or whatever. So why not make designer babies that way or make whatever you want?
Right. Well, I think there's a big difference between the way we choose our friends or our mates or our partners, which is partly on the basis of qualities that we find attractive. We choose. And the way we stand in relation to our children. I think it's an important fact about parenting and raising children that we accept our children as they come. I think the norm, the ideal of unconditional love of parents for children depends very importantly on a certain kind of acceptance, a willingness to accept and not to remake, not to regard the child as an instrument of our ambition or a product of our design. I think that's the underlying worry.
Your underlying worry also seems to be a kind of dominion. I think I'm actually paraphrasing you a bit here. Going beyond mystery, failing to appreciate the gifted character, I think is how you phrase it, of human powers.
Right.
And so that kind of tinkering offends you in a sense, doesn't it?
It does. I think it's a kind of consumerism run amok. Now, I think consumerism and choice, that ethos is fine when we're talking about commodities, when we're talking about what kind of car to buy or toaster, for example, where we can specify, and we're used to specifying, the qualities we want, the traits we want. We stand in relation to that consumer good as the buyer of a commodity. But I think it's important that we not commodify children or childhood, and the getting into the habit of trying to pick and choose the traits we want, whether it's height or eye color or hair color or IQ down the road or sex, I think runs the risk gradually of making children into commodities and parenting into an instrument of the consumer society.
But, of course, the argument is we live in a consumer society. The genies are out of the bottle. How can you possibly ward off or avert the likelihood that this is going to be carried to its logical conclusion, which means profit? It means money in people's pockets.
Well, unfortunately, that's true. I think that's a tendency that we should lean against. I think that the ethos of consumerism actually in societies like ours spills beyond its proper bounds. And so, a perfect example of what you're describing is you can go to a for-profit fertility clinic in Los Angeles. There are probably others. Pay $18,000 and choose whether your child will be a boy or a girl for reasons completely unrelated to any medical necessity, simply really as an exercise of consumer choice.
This is the PGD thing that you're talking about?
Yeah, there are two ways. PGD, or pre-implantation genetic diagnosis, essentially is embryo screening. You may have seen that movie Gattaca, a sci-fi movie actually about genetic engineering in the not-too-distant future. They imagine a world where parents routinely, when they had kids, said whether they wanted a boy or a girl, and then they specified other genetic traits of the kind that we're talking about. So that was done through embryo screening. That's one method, and it's highly reliable.
It's about 99%, isn't it?
It is. Yeah. It, in fact, that fertility clinic in Los Angeles, they don't give you a money-back guarantee for your $18,000, but they do say there's a 99.9% likelihood that you will get a boy or a girl, as you specify. There is another way of doing this, Michael, beyond embryo screening, which is sperm sorting, which is even before you create an embryo.
Sperm separation, too, I guess.
Yes. So there's a technology. It was actually invented by the U.S. Department of Agriculture to breed cattle. And now there's a for-profit fertility clinic in Fairfax, Virginia, that makes this available to people who want to choose whether to have a boy or a girl. They call it microsort, which is a quaint name.
Actually, a concern that many people have goes beyond the moral questions, which obviously I want to get into because you get into, but it has to do with accessibility. This is $17,000. This is something that, you know, only people with a lot of money in their pockets can afford to begin with.
There are real questions of equality and inequality because you can imagine a scenario where as these techniques become more fully developed and it's possible really to give one's children an edge in the competitive race, who's going to be able to afford it? Obviously, it will give a greater competitive edge to the children of families who can afford to undertake these non-medical biotechnological techniques. So equality and inequality, fairness, separation between the genetically rich and the genetically impoverished may come to track income differences, though I don't think that's the only reason. I think it would be objectionable even if there were public subsidies for, let's say, height enhancement or even IQ enhancement. I think it would still be objectionable.
But we give kids growth hormones. We give them all kinds of vitamins, and people who have money hire coaches to work with them, to give them competitive edges. All of these kinds of things, apart from biotechnology, are out there, and they're part of, again, the consumer society.
They are. And we, at a certain point, we do begin to worry about questions of fairness and access, even with those low-tech techniques of giving children an edge in a very competitive meritocratic society. We do worry about fairness in those cases. What I'm suggesting is that if we imagine that apart from sending kids to SAT prep courses and swimming lessons and tennis camp and private tutors and all the rest of it, which does raise questions about access, if we then begin to enlist biotechnology to genetically engineer advantages in our children, that will exaggerate and maybe inscribe in the genes differences between rich and poor, going beyond what we even see today.
You also compound this problem when you think about what's happening in China, when they can determine gender, for example, and you have this disproportionate number of male children being born because of fiddling with genes.
Yep,
and that's
true.
It becomes very difficult in terms of finding equality where genders are concerned. But not only that, it's hard now for Chinese boys to find mates. I mean, it's affecting the whole nature of the population. But I guess what I'm struck by here in the case that you make against perfection is that so many of these kinds of biotechnological techniques begin as ways to treat diseases or to prevent genetic disorders, and then they become part of the consumer.
Yeah.
So that's the trajectory often, isn't it?
It's true. It's true. And the sex selection example you gave is a perfect illustration. Screening embryos for sex began as a way of trying to screen out sex-linked diseases. But people have lots of other reasons for wanting a boy or a girl. And as you mentioned, Michael, in parts of Asia, sex selection has really begun to skew the demographics, the sex ratio. In China, there are about 120 boys for every 100 girls. In parts of northern India, 140 boys for every 100 girls. So, and this also points to a bigger problem with genetic engineering and sex selection, which is that it inscribes biologically prejudices that are out there, whether those prejudices are born of hierarchical societies or male-dominated societies or, like ours, intensely competitive consumerist societies.
Science moves too quickly. This is the gap, really, that we're talking about. Morality can't keep up with science. I mean, that's really the fundamental problem that you focus on here.
It is, and I think our challenge is to try, it's a challenge really for democratic societies and for public deliberation to frame public debates about the purposes to which our new biotechnology and powers, genetic and biological powers, will be applied. To what purposes?
This is where your government professor hat comes in.
Well,
fostering citizenship and public debate.
And about these questions, while there is still time to try to deliberate about the purposes and ends of biomedical research and of scientific breakthroughs. There should be a public debate about this.
Talking with Michael Sandel, his book is The Case Against Perfection, Ethics in the Age of Genetic Engineering, and he'll be speaking at Stanford today at noon and again in Berkeley in the afternoon at 4:30. All are welcome. Those are indeed open to the public to continue this debate, which we're going to have here, and we'll, of course, hear from you, our listeners, on this whole subject. There's so much to talk about in this book. It's an embarrassment of riches as far as talk shows go, but I'm also struck by the fact that you did serve on the President's Bioethics Committee, because this gets tricky. Theology often gets into this whole nature,
yes,
of the questions that we're talking about, and to some extent it's entered into the politicization of science with the Bush administration. And I'm wondering to what extent you were able to grapple with these questions of, you know, fetus being personhood and embryonic stem cells being somehow related to personhood and those kinds of things, which have been pretty hardcore from the Bush administration.
Yes. And I should say that part of what got me interested in this whole range of questions was the 4 years I spent serving on the President's Council on Bioethics. I had not really paid close attention to these issues, and I found them fascinating. Now, the first 6 months of my time on that council was devoted to the question of embryonic stem cell research and the use of cloning techniques for embryonic stem cell research. And I was among the dissenters on the Bush Council. I am in favor of federal funding for embryonic stem cell research and also for permitting the use of cloning techniques for stem cell research. So that put me in the minority. But I must say the debates that—
Minority or heretic?
Well, either way. Now, and you mentioned, Michael, and it's true that religious and theological notions enter in, especially to the stem cell debate. I'm not one who says those sources of argument should be kept out or are illegitimate. I think they are legitimate. If you believe that moral arguments have a place in politics, then I think that we should welcome, not exclude, people whose moral views may be shaped by religious traditions and convictions. So I'm not against that in principle. And some of my progressive friends, are a little bit allergic to having any religiously informed views come into politics. What I found fascinating was debating with my colleagues there who came with religiously informed views. And I think the public debate we were talking about before should welcome all comers, because it's a way of really lifting up public debate about these hard questions, which are moral questions, to the level of moral principle. And if that includes some who may have religiously informed convictions, I say that's fine. That doesn't mean that they should prevail necessarily, but they should be part of the debate.
What about the other side of the debate, which often, especially when talking about cloning or designer children or genetic engineering in general, always alludes back to eugenics and the Nazis. And, you know, you hear this from progressives, you hear this from people on the left particularly.
Yes.
And then there are those who say, we're not even talking about analogous situations here. You know, this is reductio ad absurdum somehow, and this doesn't really pertain to what we're talking about when we have this debate. What's your take on that?
I think that the whole the history of eugenics is relevant to the debate about genetic engineering and cloning in the following respect. The disanalogy, the most obvious one, is that historically eugenics was coercive. There were laws mandating forced sterilization of the so-called mentally enfeebled, or Oliver Wendell Holmes himself wrote an opinion upholding a forced sterilization law, saying three generations of imbeciles is enough, a notorious Supreme Court opinion. And then, of course, Hitler with the Nuremberg laws and with genocide. So we think of eugenics historically as bound up with coercion. And the question we have today is, suppose you remove the coercion. Suppose it's a matter of individual parents choosing the genetic traits of their children. Does that remove everything that was morally objectionable about eugenics? And I say, no, it doesn't. Coercion is not the only thing that was wrong with eugenics.
And choice is not necessarily this altar that we all should be worshiping
at? Well, I don't think so. I want to question that. What we have now really is privatized or free market eugenics, when we talk about parents trying to pick and choose designer children. And I think that's reason that's objectionable, even though it involves choice, because it really erodes the norms and the ideals, the moral goods connected with accepting children as they come without trying to manipulate their nature.
Extraneous enhancements we're talking about, or just enhancements genetically, or all of those kinds of things that come under that broad category, take away from human nature, the gift of human nature, and in a sense, compromise it?
Well, in the case of parenting, I would draw the line, and there will be debate about this, I would draw the line between the use of genetic technologies for medical purposes, for the sake of health, and the use of these technologies for non-medical purposes, for the sake of trying to give our kids a leg up in a competitive society, or trying to pick and choose the kind of child we happen to want or like, or we'll be able to brag about at cocktail parties and with our friends because they got into an Ivy League school. That's the distinction I would make. And I think we should try to embody that distinction in the practices that we ultimately adopt for governing these technologies.
Including, actually, because you go into it in the book, the sports arena.
Yes, yes.
But yet, you know, you talk about this Nike experiment in your book where they put these people up in high altitudes and you know, all the things that go, Tiger Woods getting LASIK surgery, all of these things are enhancements, really. Are there ways of getting a better performance?
They are. Performance-enhancing technologies is a hard question. We're wrestling with it now. What is wrong? Here's an interesting hypothetical to get at this. Everybody, almost everybody, agrees that Barry Bonds or other players using steroids is objectionable. But the most obvious reason it's objectionable, well, two, safety and fairness.
And also the bad example for kids, too, I think.
Yeah, and it's a bad example for kids because it's medically harmful to health in the long run, and it's a form of cheating. But here's the hard question. Suppose there were a kind of gene therapy that would enhance muscles that did not pose long-term health danger. And we may be on the verge, actually, of finding such a kind of gene therapy for muscles. And suppose, to deal with the fairness argument, it were made available to anyone who wanted to use it. Would it then be fine? Or would bionic athletes, essentially, change and diminish what we most appreciate about sports? I think that it would change and diminish. It would turn sports increasingly into a spectacle if we had souped up bionically enhanced athletes, even if there were no long-term health risk and everyone could use it.
Of course, compared to the way athletes used to look, they are souped up and bionic today. You think about how small they were in the days of Wee Willie Keeler and people like that.
It's true.
I mean, true. And a lot of that has to do with nutrition. A lot of that has to do with training and so forth, doesn't it? That's enhancement.
Well, it is a kind of enhancement, but it is in line with the fundamental purpose of athletic competition, which I would say has to do with developing and displaying and honoring and appreciating natural talents and gifts. So running shoes, when the first runner put on a pair of running shoes, everyone else had run barefoot, he might have been accused, or she, of tainting the race, of using an unfair enhancement.
Was a running coach in Chariots of Fire?
Well, that's a great one. Yeah,
people felt that was unacceptable. I mean, it was based on an actual Olympic competition.
Yeah. And these old Cambridge dons said this violated the spirit of amateur athletics. Whether they were right or not to object depends on whether having a coach actually perfects or corrupts college sports as an arena within which people develop and display their natural talents. So there was an argument both ways there. But there's a certain point at which enhancement actually corrupts. I mean, here's an example.
An absolute enhancement corrupts absolutely.
Well, Rosie Ruiz was a woman marathon runner in the Boston Marathon. You remember her?
Of course.
And she won the Boston Marathon. Until they discovered she had used an enhancement. She took off from the starting line, got on the subway, and rode to just before the finish line, got out, and ran across first. Now, what distinguishes running shoes, the coach in Chariots of Fire, and the subway, and a drug, say human growth hormone, or muscle enhancement? I think all are enhancements. The ones that are legitimate are the ones that perfect rather than obscure the qualities, the natural talents that sports at their best are meant to display. That's how I would look at it anyhow. These are hard questions.
They are hard questions. And in fact, I'm going to throw them out to our listeners and get you involved in this discussion with Michael Sandel, who is with us. He's the author of The Case Against Perfection. He's also a professor of government at Harvard. And what he says essentially in this book is, in this case against perfection, ethics in the age of genetic engineering, is that choice is not enough of an ethic for a democratic society. What we really need is more of an emphasis on citizenship, on community, on civic virtue. And let's get you involved in this. Phone lines are open and available, and we welcome your calls. Our toll-free number, 866-733-6786. Again, if you have questions or comments and like to contribute to this discussion, it's toll-free from wherever you're listening to us or however, on the radio, the Internet, or the Sirius satellite, 866-733-6786. You can also email us. Our email address here is forum@kqed.org. And a reminder that Michael Sandel will be at Stanford today at noon and again at Berkeley this afternoon at 4:30, continuing the discussion about these very important topics. But when we return, your calls and emails on Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. We're talking this hour with Michael Sandel, and he's Harvard professor of government as well as the author of The Case Against Perfection, Ethics in the Age of Genetic Engineering. We're going to go to your calls and emails forthwith. I want to mention again, though, that he'll be at Stanford Center for Biomedical Ethics on the Stanford campus this afternoon from 12 to 1:30 and at the Berkeley City Club, 2315 Durant Avenue in Berkeley from 4:30 to 6 later on today. And for more information, you can go to the Center for Genetics and Society website, which is www.geneticsandsociety.org. And again, we're talking about ethics in the age of genetic engineering. How do you get a message like this across? I mean, you write a book, obviously, you go on a radio program where you have thousands of listeners and so forth, but the message seems to be, in many ways, well, obfuscated by so many things. I mean, people don't necessarily want to hear a moral message, and that's to some extent what you're giving.
I think the biggest challenge, Michael, goes back to something you said just before the break, and it goes beyond biotechnology. It has to do with the ethic of choice, and especially of consumer choice, that is so deeply embedded in American society and politics that any view that challenges that underlying ethic, it really has its work cut out for it.
But it's our freedom, people say, right? I mean, it has to do with a kind of basic American tenet of the idea or ideal of freedom.
It does, but I think a certain kind of consumerist ideal of freedom misses what freedom really is, which I think has to do with engaging in public deliberation, being a citizen, sharing in self-government, and to try to fix ourselves and our children better to fit the roles that the existing society has marked out for us, trying to change our nature to fit the world. That's actually disempowering, if you think about it. It isn't really an exercise of freedom. So that's part of the larger message that I'm hoping we can at least have a debate about.
Well, we'll hear from our listeners with questions and comments and involvement. Tom, you're first up. Good morning.
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I am somebody who experiences mild to somewhat severe depression on an ongoing basis, and it's been suggested by my therapist that this is actually an inherited, problem. My parents have it. So my question is, if I'm in fact somebody who is going to pass this genetic trait on to my children, what's the difference between selecting, a gene pool for my child that is going to be ensure that his happiness in his life, or at least predisposed to happiness, versus consigning him to being on a regimen of drugs to keep him happy for the rest of his life?
Well, it's a good question and a hard question. And we don't currently have, I should say, first of all, we don't currently have genetic testing for depression. But if it were developed, then it seems to me the question would be whether that form of genetic screening were for the sake of health, which I would say it is, rather than for the sake of non-medical enhancement. So I think if we were to develop such a test, or if we were to develop a way of treating genetically or pharmacologically depression, I think that would, my view is that would fall under the category of health rather than under the category of non-medical enhancement.
I thank you, Tom, for the call. Good luck to you. I want to go to more of your calls, and we'll go next to Jason in Cotati. Good morning, Jason.
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I just wanted to kind of take an extreme example of society as a whole. Wouldn't we be better off with more geniuses and fewer psychopaths, even if I'm still average?
Yeah, we can create a designer society here, right? That's every utopian dream.
Well, you know, Jason, your proposal was actually taken up around 1980 by a philanthropic eugenicist who set up a sperm bank called the Repository for Germinal Choice, but its more common name was the Nobel Prize Sperm Bank because
it's right here in San Diego. I mean, it was located in San Diego, I believe.
It was somewhere in California.
Yeah.
Was it San Diego?
Yeah.
And his idea was to collect the sperm of Nobel Prize winning scientists and make it available to women in hopes of creating, Jason, as you're suggesting, more geniuses or at least super smart babies. It didn't work very well. He had trouble recruiting Nobel scientists to contribute to his sperm bank, and so he had to settle for young scientists who were very promising. But
except, I think, for Shockley.
Was the only one, and there may be a moral tale in that, too. So I think that project was clearly eugenic, even though it was voluntary. It did not involve coercion. And I think it was objectionable for the same kinds of reasons that all eugenic projects are objectionable.
Let me thank the caller. And speaking about Shockley, here's Connie, who emails us. What is Mr. Sandel's take on the difference between genetic selection for gender and selection for race? In this society, race and economic, political, and social access are so closely correlated. A family choosing a sperm donor based on race is not so different. And clearly, some people are classified as one race or another by criteria of their generation and by skin color rather than any real genetic trait.
It's a very good question. I think, and it's true, we tend to, in our society, be more sympathetic to, well, selection for race or race matching. Here would be a question. There's a debate about race matching in adoption, whether that should be permitted or encouraged or not. But the real test of this, of the point Connie raises, is in the donor catalogs of commercial sperm banks, including California Cryobank, which now is not set up as a eugenic project like the Nobel Prize Bank, but it's a commercial enterprise. They and other commercial sperm banks have very elaborate donor catalogs that specify the race of the donors, height, weight, college major, and other physical characteristics. Now, this is already widespread. This is not high-tech or science fiction. And yet, it seems to me that the very elaborate donor catalogs that include all of those traits, including race, I think raise similar kinds of questions.
What about when you're having what the plastic surgeons like to call aesthetic surgery? I mean, this is a kind of non-medical enhancement in many respects. It's the argument is, well, it makes me feel better, my self-esteem, all of those kinds of things. But
right.
Really, it is non-medical.
Cosmetic surgery, yeah, meaning that yeah. It's not correcting some injury or defect.
Exactly.
Yes, it is. And I think that raises... Now that does not... That's something people do to themselves, typically, not usually to their children, although that can happen as well. But I think even cosmetic surgery of a non-medical kind raises similar kinds of questions. Now, would I ban it? No. But here's a modest proposal to reflect...
Sounds like Swift, yeah.
Well, here's a modest proposal. I think that those doctors who make their living with cosmetic, non-medical cosmetic surgery should be required to repay all of the federal subsidies and loans that supported their medical education, which are substantial, because they are not really performing a public service. They're performing a consumer service, and so they should not enjoy that kind of subsidy. At a minimum, I think it's a way of registering the moral distinction between serving health and serving people's consumer desires.
Did you mention this in the Council of Bioethics when you were
serving? I
did. Serving? Because
I did.
What interests me about that proposal is I happen to know some plastic surgeons, and they do pro bono work, and they go out to places, you know, far away and deal with war victims,
yeah,
and so forth, and do plastic surgery of that nature. It's certainly much more, you
yes.
know, in the moral realm, yeah?
Yes. Well, I find that admirable, and that would be another way. I mean, one could require that kind of pro bono work or require a repayment. But it's really a question. Now, health, promoting health, is a public good. And yet, when medical techniques and technologies and skills are diverted from treating health, which is a public good, to satisfying people's individual desires, which is a private good, I think that there should be a way of reflecting that in the public's support.
Then there's the argument that affecting the private good helps the public good ultimately, because the private good enhanced can add to or contribute to the public good, and does. I mean, you get a citizen who has better self-esteem. That's the argument for cosmetic surgery often, that it helps the whole community.
It's a stretch, Michael.
All right, I'm just playing here. Here's James from Rohnert Park. He says, in my mind, the most convincing benefit that genetic engineering brings to the world is the betterment of the species. How much better could life be if we take evolution into our own hands and focus it?
I think it would be less good. But this has long been the argument of the eugenics movement, which is that, you know, as human beings, we want to conquer nature, exercise dominion over nature, Why should we simply regard ourselves as the creatures of an evolutionary process when now we have the power to take evolution into our own hands and to direct it to our own purposes? That's the ambition. I think what's wrong with that ambition is, first of all, maybe we shouldn't be so confident that we have the wisdom to direct the course of evolution and to take it into our own hands. Do we really know that selecting out certain traits that seem inconvenient won't have effects? Suppose we wanted to select out, not that we can do it now, traits like aggression, or for that matter, inattentiveness by children in schoolroom classes. If we use biotech to fiddle with our nature to make kids sit still in classrooms, then what other traits may be associated with that rebelliousness, that squirminess? Perhaps unconventional kids or kids who are impatient with the established order. I don't think we are wise enough to know just how to manipulate our nature if we take evolution into our own hands.
When I hear you speak that way, it seems to me that the morality that you're coming from, so to speak, is classical. It's Hellenistic. It's Greek tragedy. We have too much hubris, and our hubris can lead us down a path of destruction.
Well, I think I am worried about hubris, and I'm worried about a certain Promethean ambition, the idea that the ultimate purpose of human beings is to exercise mastery and control and dominion over nature, including our own human nature, and that freedom depends on our ability to master the forces of nature and to master evolution itself. I think that is a kind of hubris, it's a kind of overreaching that I think misses a truer understanding of what freedom consists in.
On we go to more of your calls. Danielle joining us. Good morning, Danielle. You're on forum.
Hello. I was going back to the issue of enhancement regarding sports. And I think one thing that is very admirable in sports is just the effort and the achievement, the satisfaction that you get from knowing that you put forth your best and it was your own. It was all your own doing. And I think that makes the difference between, like, a running shoe and using steroids. Because with a running shoe, you're still basically putting forth the same effort.
Right.
I don't know if that's...
No, it's good. It's good. It's a good point. You know, Danielle, there was one... writer who was sympathetic, defending performance enhancement, who said, well, let's have both kinds of sports competitions. Let's have some leagues that have genetically enhanced bionic athletes, and then have other leagues that are enhancement-free, drug-free. And he called the second group the free-range slowpokes, have races, and see which ones would get the higher television ratings, and the writer thought that the souped-up athletes would, but I'm not sure. I think that part of what draws us to an appreciation of athletic competition is an appreciation of the display of natural talents and gifts, and that would be turned into a kind of spectacle if subject to a kind of bionic enhancement.
Danielle, we thank you for the call. Before I go to more calls, I want to go to a few more emails here. Here's Mark, who writes, the fairness argument can be easily countered by the fact that over time, genetic selection would become very inexpensive and available to everybody. Once everybody can have enhanced children, hopefully through some form of universal health insurance, I think the playing field might actually be made more even. We've reached a point in evolution where our abilities, thanks to technology, are quickly outpacing what natural evolution can offer us. I think it's time for technology to take over the role of evolution on our genes. Just think of the money we'd save on health care.
Well, I don't know that we would save money, Mark, on health care. I'm all for universal health insurance. But I would not be keen to devote it to genetic engineering and enhancement. Now, I suppose you could make the argument that perhaps we could design it to enhance equality rather than to create inequality. But I think given the way our society operates, that's not very likely to happen. The affluent inevitably will have greater access to these technologies. And even if there were public subsidies for the poor and those who couldn't afford them, I still think there would be further moral objections beyond the fairness question. Though I'm afraid that in our society, I don't think that the fairness objection is likely to disappear.
Talking with Michael Sandel, his book is The Case Against Perfection. Here's another listener, Tom, who writes, I have a comment. Question about today's guest. I am of the opinion that no one should be barred from the freedom of choice. I see it as an extension or acceleration of natural evolution mechanism. Everyone should be entitled to choosing what he or she thinks would be best for their offsprings, whether before or after birth. However, what I find objectionable is this selection pressure of the society itself, the kind of social values that favor intelligence, athleticism, etc. As long as we have such values, sooner or later, we'll evolve toward what we consider to be the perfection defined by these values. What does the guest think of that viewpoint?
I certainly agree with the second half of Tom's viewpoint, that there is a powerful selection pressure so that when we speak of freedom and when we speak of choice, in a way, that isn't what's going on. What's going on is that parents, in selecting certain traits to enable their children to compete more effectively given the social pressures, parents are really conforming. It's not an exercise of freedom. Parents are conforming to what Tom calls the selection pressures for the traits marked out by our particular society. So it's caving into convention. It's not really exercising freedom. Now, the first part of what Tom has to say, I'm not sure I agree with, which is that if there were no selection pressure, then all would be well. But the fact of the matter is there is no society that doesn't mark out certain roles as being honored or highly rewarded or especially prestigious. There is no society in which there is no selection pressure. And so long as that's true, genetic engineering for designer children will not really be the kind of true exercise of free choice that Tom suggests, I don't think.
We go to more of your calls. Gretchen, thanks for waiting. You're on with us. Good morning.
Hi, how are you?
Hi.
I have a question and an observation. My question is, many women, especially women over 35, who are pregnant, routinely do genetic screening to discover if their baby has any genetic anomalies such as Down syndrome. And lots of people, if they get a positive result for these tests, elect not to continue their pregnancy. So I'm wondering if your guest considers this to be eugenics. And then my observation is just kind of the question of economic fairness. He mentioned $17,000 for, getting the genetic gender chosen. But even ordinary IVF is very expensive. It's about $10,000. And for that matter, adoption isn't cheap either. It ranges from, in my studies, from around $8,000 to $40,000. So for people who cannot have children the sort of normal way, there is a question of economic access that enters into it.
Well, Gretchen, to take your last point first, I agree that not only for fertility treatments, but for a whole range of medical treatments, there are grave and, I would say, unjustified unfairnesses in access. So I agree, the fairness argument is not unique to non-medical enhancement. It applies across the board. As for Gretchen's question about Down syndrome, embryo screening for Down syndrome, is that eugenic? That's a very hard question, and it's a difficult question, I find. I myself think that embryo screening for medical purposes is morally defensible. Now, Down syndrome, there are more and less severe versions of Down syndrome, And there are some parents who bring children with Down syndrome into the world and can't imagine doing otherwise, and of course deeply love the child, and the child has a very good life. So Gretchen's question, is it eugenic to select against Down syndrome? I think that's a very close call, and it's morally difficult call, whichever on both sides, because there are parents now who have Down syndrome children who find that they are judged critically since they now have the choice. Other people will say, why did you bring that child into the world? You could have done otherwise. And I think that's a great tragedy. And it's the kind of tragedy that comes with actually when technology expands the choice and therefore the frame of moral responsibility. So I think these are wrenching questions, and I don't think there's an easy call.
It gets back to what we spoke of earlier with, you know, selecting a deaf child. I mean, as opposed to labeling that a disability, particularly from the vantage point of those who are deaf, those who have Down syndrome children say these children are natural, we love them, there's nothing to feel that we should have destroyed this child.
Yes,
I mean, it's not necessarily even a pro-life argument in many instances.
That's right.
That's the child I love.
You know? Yes, yeah, and I have enormous respect for parents who make that choice and who make that point, and I think it's a very important point to hear. Now, there is a difference with the deaf case we were discussing before where the parents deliberately chose to have a deaf child by design, so to speak, whereas in the case of the parents who bring to term a child with Down syndrome, it's not that they went out seeking a child with Down syndrome in the first instance, but they accepted it as a gift and had the child. So they're different in that respect. But I have enormous respect for the parents who make that point.
And I thank Gretchen for bringing that up, and we'll go to another one of your calls. Brian, good morning. You're on Forum.
Yeah, hi. I think that the last couple of points that have come up have really started to identify a problem, which is that how are you going to distinguish between what you think is a medical good as opposed to a non-medical or public or private good? At what point do you decide that low intelligence is a medical issue as opposed to a non-medical issue? Who's going to make the call as to whether a kid is just squirmy or whether a kid or whether those same genetic traits cause attention deficit disorder, which is really a medical problem? You seem to think it's not a medical problem. So my question to you is, what is the moral distinction between choosing to value something for its medical because it's a medical good as opposed to a non-medical good? What makes a medical good morally superior?
Right. That's a great question, Brian. Actually, I think you've got two questions there. One is, what is the distinction? How do we distinguish in hard cases between medical and non-medical cases? And then the second issue is, if we can make that distinction, why do I say that it's more important to treat medical than non-medical conditions? So to go to the first question, which I think is actually the hardest one, there are some close calls. I don't mean to suggest, when I was talking about squirmy children, I didn't mean to suggest that there is no such thing as ADHD as a medical condition. I accept that there is, and that Ritalin is an appropriate treatment for ADHD. It's also true that Ritalin works on children, adolescents, and others who don't have any attention deficit disorder but simply avail themselves of it before they take a final exam or the SAT. So there's a clear case between treating a medical condition and using, say, Ritalin for enhancement. There are close calls, I will grant you that, and there will be debates about where to draw the line. One of the debates is over deafness, as we've already discussed. Another is height. The use of human growth hormone is approved for those who suffer a hormone deficiency or dwarfism, but it's not approved by the FDA, let's say for a kid of average height who wants to make the basketball team. Now, where do we draw the line exactly with respect to height? It's, Brian, it's a legitimate question, and likewise for IQ. But why the distinction matters, which is really the second question, I think the distinction matters because medical treatment actually is trying to restore natural or normal human functioning, which is an essential human good. It's essential to living a good life. Whereas non-medical enhancement is not the same kind of good. It may make people happier. It may fulfill their desires. But it's more on a par with a consumer good than a medical good. And I do think morally that health is morally more important as a human good than satisfying people's consumer desires.
Now, here's a listener who takes the argument to task and says, the hubris is in pretending we aren't already doing all of this. This debate then turns around what is natural. What is natural is that most of us die at age 26 from an infectious disease, so much for the natural argument. It's got a point.
Right.
In terms of enhancements, or what we generally label enhancements.
Yeah. Well, right. I wouldn't rely simply on the notion of the natural. Smallpox and malaria are given by nature, and I would be happy to eradicate both. So I'm not celebrating nature as such. So where does the hubris come in? It comes in, I think, when we start to go beyond using our scientific ingenuity to restore people to health, to normal human flourishing, and instead begin to use it as part of a Promethean ambition to transform and enhance human nature.
And there's where we'll have to conclude with Prometheus. Thank you so much, Michael Sandel. He'll be again at Berkeley this afternoon, as well as Stanford. And if you want more information, go to geneticsandsociety.org. I want to thank our producers, Robin Giannatasio-Mall, Hermione G., and Kevin Guillory. Our engineer is Danny Bringer. Our executive producer is Raul Ramirez. And I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Claude and Louise Rosenberg Jr. Family Foundation.